Well, hello, good evening, and welcome to the first show of February. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on the stream tonight. And we're going to have an interesting conversation with Damien on the markets and what's been going on. A very interesting January, of course. And the question is, what's going to happen now? Just before we bring him in, let me just remind you that, as always, we don't provide specific financial or legal advice. This is a general conversation. Please do play nice in the chat room. We do moderate the stream. This is at the 1st of February. Use at Walk the World to get my attention. There's lots of chat goes on. I'm happy and very encouraging of the chat. But if you want to ask a question, make sure you use at Walk the World. And I've also enabled Super Chat. In fact, a couple of people have already made contributions. Thank you for that. But you can also use Super Chat to get your question to the top of the queue. And without further ado, let me push this button and bring Damien in. Hello.
Button, how are you going?
I'm pretty good. How are you going?
Oh, very well. Very well. Nice to be back after a bit of a holiday, but markets kept falling, so I had to keep watching. So
I was going to say, how much of it? Was it a busman's holiday, or were you actually able to take some time off?
Oh, look, I think I actually don't mind following markets. It's an entertaining thing. It's having to do all the rest of the work. That's the yes. That's the hard part. So, yeah. Well, it was good holiday.
Yeah, yes. Great. Well, that's good to see. And thanks very much for coming back. And actually, I think timing was really good because, of course, we got to the end of January. And, of course, the markets were very wobbly through January. But the last few days, they've been a little less wobbly. And so it's a really interesting question now as to precisely where they go from here.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll talk about. I'm sure as we go, we'll talk about lots of different options. But you know, I think there's two big scenarios that you have to, let's take the bull and the bear case. There's obviously lots of stuff in between. But the bull case in a nutshell is that earnings are still strong. Wage growth still looks pretty good for low income workers. And that what we're headed for is it's been a bit of a consolidation. You can buy a bit cheaper, but the Fed's still going to keep things very loose, and monetary policy around the world is going to stay loose, and so valuations will stay high, and so here's a chance to get in. That's your bull case. Your bear case is we're headed for a policy error, and that what the Fed's trying to do really in a simple sense is they're trying to smash demand in order to bring demand down to the reduced supply. So we've got we haven't got enough supply. Demand sort of about average, maybe a little bit high on the good side, and they're trying to they want to smash that down so that they can meet this the poor supply market. And the problem there is then when the supply comes good and you've already smashed demand, it's very hard to pick it back up again and get it going. And so in which case, if that's the case, then there's a lot more weakness to come.
Yeah, and this is interesting. The couple of people in the Fed have been talking about a 50 basis point drop as the first move, right? It's a sort of bit of shock and awe. But, Of course, I keep reminding people, the Fed is still doing more quantitative easing. They're still printing more at the moment. They're still buying more bonds. So they've actually done nothing so far.
No, that's right. We're still headed in the opposite direction. But the key question really is should they? Because they obviously look like they're going to, and they've even got quite extraordinarily they've even got the Biden out there exhorting them on to bring inflation under control. And the problem is as a sort of led is that if the problem is that we haven't got enough supply, then raising interest rates doesn't help you with supply. All it does is it makes you're basically saying, I want more people to have to put more money into their mortgages. I want more people to be unemployed so that we can bring this demand, this roaring demand, back down to meet the level of supply and therefore get rid of inflation. And if you haven't got roaring demand in the first place, then all we're going to do is add to that unemployment issues.
Absolutely. Well, there's a couple of interesting slides. I'll just put this one up. This is from Bloomberg. That makes the point that the post-Christmas correction is sort of over, at least for the moment, right? We had a significant fall through January, but actually in recent days, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ has started to go the other way, which I think is, one way to argue it, although you could make a different argument. And the other way, of course, to bear it in mind is that if you look at it like this, the NASDAQ is cheapest in nearly 2 years, right? Because it's come back. although, of course, it's still more expensive than it was between 2007 and the pandemic. So I don't know what that tells you, but it just shows you that we are in very, very interesting territory at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there's a lot of – I've got a chart I'll show later on, but, you know, in terms of let's flick to that one, actually. I might just jump forward and I'll show you that one, which is this one. Okay. This is your valuation sort of over time. Maybe people have sort of seen various versions of this, but basically the idea is that, you know, on the left-hand side, you sort of get the smart money, so to speak, get into whatever the latest fad's going to be, and then the institutional investors come next, and then you get this little bear trap where the markets fall, and then just before they go through this massive rise as the public gets involved, and you get greed and delusion and all these things like that, and you get this new paradigm at the top where things are different now. And valuations are going to be high forever, and you know this is the new world we live in. And then you get this fallback, what they call a bull trap, and then the market bounces again before it finally capitulates and goes through the back to more normal valuations. And so I guess the question is, are we sitting at this bull trap, or are we still in the greed and delusion part? And is this just a minor setback in our greed and delusion? So, we've still got higher to go on that side. And, I think there's obviously reason. There's always arguments on both sides. But, I think you do need to recognize that we are in a valuation bubble. It's a question about how long, every time I come on here, we talk about how long central banks and governments can maintain it for. And at the moment, they're making noise. The noises they're making is they don't want to keep maintaining it. Now they want to get inflation under control. And in a way, what's really been happening is the Fed's been using asset prices to help juice demand, and there's other central banks as well. So you lower interest rates and the asset prices go up, and some people are happier, and so they go out and spend. And so it's a little bit different to other cycles in that the whole thing that's driving it is this. Is the market, and so if they raise rates too much, then they start smashing the market down, and that sort of potentially goes into you're in this pro-cyclical part where if the market's your only they say they don't want to rescue the stock market, but if that's the only reason why you're keeping demand up because you're inflating asset prices, then maybe they have to step in, and I think that's why my expectation is that I do think we're in a bit of a bull trap now. And I do think that they are making a policy error in terms of saying yes, we want to smash demand down to meet reduced supply, because I do think supply will come roaring back at some stage once we sort of move through the Omicrons and we start people start getting to be able to work sort of full shifts and things like that again, but I also don't think we'll go through this full cycle where you go through the whole fear and capitulation and drop right away, because I think the Fed doesn't want that to happen, and they'll have if the market fell, I don't know, maybe another 15%, 20%, I think they would panic and start trying to step in and help, because they realize when you're blowing this big bubble to try and keep everything going by asset bubbles, you can't let that asset bubble pop.
Right, and I think the markets were assuming that the Fed would always save them. Until very recently, right? Yeah. And they were expecting essentially no change. And then when suddenly the Fed veered and started talking about inflation, and that was definitely politically driven, the re-election or the reaffirmation of Powell as head and those sorts of things. And the fact that, the president was also pushing very hard on that was part of it. But I think markets have been quite surprised by the change in direction from the Fed now, but it's all words at the moment.
Nothing
has changed, right?
No,
than words from the Fed, and I think that's really interesting.
Well, yeah, that brings us to another point. Sorry, just want to say I have checked myself; it's not COVID, but I have got a bit of a cough, and it's what are the odds of catching the flu in the summer in Australia and it not being COVID at the moment? I think. Must be a small minority. So I was saying Yeah, it's almost this Jedi mind trick, or everything's running sort of before it has to do. Like the Fed just has to talk about, hey, we're thinking about doing this, and then the market sort of runs away and does it for them. And then they're like, well, now we've changed their mind and we're thinking about doing something else, and the market reverses it or does whatever. And so you're right, everything's preempting. And this cycle, you know, keep in mind where, you know, how far are we into this? 2 years, not even into the whole COVID bit. And it's just like this cycle on amphetamines. You know, the speed of what we've seen over the last 2 years would ordinarily last like a 5 or 7 year, you know, period in terms of, you know, you go through a crash and then eventually the government steps in and starts helping, and then you go through that crash, and the fallout from companies would have taken a few years, and then the recovery part, and then now you're getting to the stage where, okay, is the recovery starting to heat up enough to start, you know, raising rates and all that type of stuff? Usually that's a, you know, 3-4 year cycle, and so we've just, everything's just very, very condensed in terms of this, and the market's sort of moving before things are happening, before things have even started to happen.
And I wonder whether the RBA is trying that same Jedi trick too, right? Because, of course, they came out today with their statement, which was essentially, well, we're going to stop buying more bonds from early February. We're not going to do anything on interest rates for some time. We don't think inflation is really that strong at the moment. It's still not above our target range. It's going to be very much driven by the supply chain slide rather than anything else. And wages growth is really the touchstone, right?
Yep.
That was their, in a nutshell, what they said. But actually, if you stand back and think about it, they're actually saying very little in terms of anything, right?
No, but I think as well, we've been through this globalization period, and now a lot of people, what's happening in the US, they think is happening in Australia as well. And it's like the US has got, you know, headlines, 7% inflation or whatever, therefore Australia needs to raise rates. And it's like, well, yeah, but we haven't got the same, you know, it's not the same structure. We haven't got the same issues. We haven't got the same inflation. We haven't got the same wage growth. You sort of go through those parts where, so many of the things that are happening in the US aren't happening or certainly not happening anywhere near the extent in Australia. And the flip side is the bond yields in Australia are actually higher than what you can get in the US for a lot of the time. And so, it's sort of this weird part, where, especially for the Aussie dollar, where, yeah, the Aussie dollar has been quite weak recently over this time, which is, you know, one of those things we'd been speaking about, sure, on this last show, is where when generally speaking, it's not, it doesn't happen every time, but generally speaking, when you do get these pullbacks in international, the Aussie dollar falls as well, and that helps cushion the blow. Mm. And so, yes, international markets come off 10%, but the Aussie dollar's fallen 3 or 4%, and so now you're only down, you know, 5 or 6 on your international versus the Aussie market, where, you know, you obviously get a 1-for-1 in terms of those. So so then in terms of currency, we've got really high iron ore prices, which is, you know, something that really drives the Aussie dollar usually. We've got higher interest rates than what you've got overseas, but on the flip side, we've got the Aussie dollar's been falling. And so the question is, if the US does start raising rates and Australia is holding still, and that yield reverses and the market changes its mind on that, and we see some more flow back from property sector in China, then, you know, quite potentially the Aussie dollar's, well, at face value, you'd say the Aussie dollar would have considerably more downside if you sort of took away that support of iron ore, potentially some of the coal and oil and gas as well, if that sort of weakens a bit. And then interest rates, none of them are sort of positive for the Aussie dollar. And it's quite interesting, actually, the Aussie dollar's fallen as far as it has in the face of, you know, all these notionally positive things that would ordinarily be pushing the Aussie dollar higher.
Absolutely. And, there is still a bit of a debate about, is it going to go higher or lower? And there are still a number of economists calling it 75 to 80. I'm personally in the 60 to 65 camp at the moment, all I'm seeing. And, China, of course, is the other big factor here, because we know that there are some interesting things happening in China. I mean, China's actually pulled the rates lower there, and they've actually reduced the capital ratios for some of the banks, and they are trying to find ways for some of the property developers to find a way to fund some of their stuff, although not a lot of it. But they're still working within this set of parameterizations that have been provided to protect the overall economy from the property sector.
Yeah, that's right. And I saw an interesting, somebody put together the list of all the things they'd done, and there was a list of, it must be 24 or more minor things that they'd done to try and sort of help prop up the property sector or help out, and probably in bigger parts, help out other sectors of the economy. And so, just to preface as well, for anyone who hasn't listened in, my view is very much that, and I think we'll probably share this view, is that there's been way too much building in China. It's just relative to the amount of population that they need to move into cities and all that type of stuff. It's just been far in advance. And one of the key stats that shows that is that the listed developers in China, even after pulling back, if you add up the value of all the listed property developers in China, that's still greater than the rest of the world put together. And so they've got this, they've built way too much in there, and they need to bring that property sector back to a more normal size. And it's sort of 25, 30% of the economy. It should be more like 15. And so they need to do something to pull that back. My take is that what they've really been doing is they've got a couple of big policies to really try and pull that sector back. They don't want to crash the rest of the economy. And so they're doing 101 small things to try and make sure that the whole ship doesn't go down, but they don't. They need that. They know they need to deflate that property sector. Now's the best possible time to do it because there's this massive goods boom right around the world, and so industrial production in China has really been booming for the last year at least, and that's that gives them an opportunity. They get to weaken their property sector. There's still lots of employment and things going on in China, so it's a great chance to try and rebalance. I think there's the inevitable part is they do need to sort of bring that back to more normal level, and as much as you see all these 101 small things they're doing and sort of get comfort, the Chinese government will have you back. The truth is, to date, they haven't got property investors back. All they're trying to do is manage the fallout. Mm-hmm. And so so that's my take on it. I've got two charts I wanted to show. One on property sales.
Okay, let me put that one up. There you go.
Yeah, so I just wanted to highlight that there's a red line of just property sales in the 30 major cities across China, and really just highlighting that we're 20 to 30% down on that usual sort of level of sort of 5,000 to 6,000 that they're looking at. So And you can see sort of where we are now and where we've been for the last year or two. Yes, it has improved. It's not sort of fallen away as far as what it is, but it's nowhere near back to what it was before. So these property developers that are that have these massive inventories, they're building far more than they've ever built before. The amount of floor area under construction is at record highs, and they've got to try to sell these properties into a market that really just isn't strong in terms of the property sales. That was one side. And the other side is, this is the Chinese high yield property market, so the debt market for China, and it's just sort of showing that, and unfortunately, it's they're doing sort of some weird units, but basically, the average over the last 10 years or so has been about 7.5% that these property developers can borrow at and then go out and buy property. And it's 28% at the moment. Yes, it's down from its highs. It's not it's not above 42% where it sort of peaked out in at the end of last year, but it's still really, really high. And it's not at the levels where if you're borrowing at 28%, you either have the world's greatest investment you're making and you can handle borrowing at 28% because you're going to make whatever it is 50-60% on your earnings, so it doesn't really matter, or you're desperate and you need that so that you don't go broke tomorrow. And my contention is that's where most of these companies are, is that the only reason that anyone's borrowing at these levels or close to, if they can get it, is that they're worried they're going to go broke. And so as much as you talk about, you know, rate cuts and all that type of stuff, if you're borrowing at 28%, you know, it doesn't matter if they just not slice 50 basis points off. Well, so now I can borrow at 27.5%, you know. It's the availability of credit. It's not the price that's really affected these. Yeah. But what I guess you hope for is that the Chinese consumer gets out and buys more apartments. And that's problematic in its own right, in that home ownership is already 90% in China. So what you're really hoping is that people are actually out, they're going to get out there and buy more investment properties. There's been talk about, and it's quite possible actually, that what we'll see in terms of government intervention is the government sort of stepping in and taking over some of these half-finished properties and using them to as low-income housing, which is which makes a lot of sense. The problem with that is so many of the houses in China are actually unoccupied that when you're using it for low-income housing, that actually sort of means, almost by definition, they will be occupied, which means you have fewer people in the rest of the market. And so it's that part about that they're in this very very difficult position, is that they have a property bubble that they're trying to ease their way out of it. I think they're happy to sacrifice the developers in terms of common prosperity. They just don't want to sacrifice the rest of the economy. And so you're going to see them do another 101 small things to try and make sure that they don't implode the rest of the economy. In terms of bringing this to heel, and it's going to be a delicate balance, and I wish them luck. They'll be one of the first economies ever to be able to manage to do it. So if they manage it, I don't know. I think the odds are against it that way, but it might happen. Yeah.
But I guess it also has a flow on effect for demand for iron ore and the steel and things, isn't it?
Absolutely. The property sector is the biggest consumer of iron ore globally. The Chinese property sector is the biggest consumer. And so there's talk about infrastructure projects taking over to help out with iron ore demand. And that's true to an extent. The problem is that the way China's set up at the moment is that it's what we call pro-cyclical, is that when property prices are going up, the entity that benefits the most is local governments, because they're out actually selling more land, and that's how they get most of their revenue, is by these land sales. So they take the money from those land sales and then they go and invest that in infrastructure, and then they rinse and repeat, and then new property developers build more things, and then they build more infrastructure for them, and this is great symbiotic relationship. But the problem is, when it starts going the other direction, is now you have these local governments who aren't selling their property to developers. They're having trouble selling their land to developers because the developers are all have these debt limits and can't make it, and they're going through that, as you saw, 28% interest rates. And so they've been setting up some special vehicles, purpose vehicles, to actually sell them to themselves, effectively. You're basically bringing on debt to buy this land and then taking the money from that debt that's raised and going and trying to build infrastructure. There will be infrastructure, and it will be probably at similar levels to the last few years, maybe even a little bit higher, but it's not going to be anywhere near enough to offset this demand fall in from property building. And it's going to be limited by that. Now they really do have to put a lot of debt into it. So and officials there have constraints as well as to how much debt they can raise. So they're not getting, they've basically lost a huge chunk of their revenue, and then they're being asked to go out and spend more money. And that's, there's obviously a limit to how much they will do that voluntarily without, sort of being told, at the point of a gun, you need to go out and build this stuff.
Yes. And, it's just worth remembering again, just what proportion of the total Chinese economy is actually anchored to the property sector, right? It is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. About double, any other economy at its peak. If you look at the US market, just before 2007, you look at the Spanish market, you look at other markets, any of these big housing booms you've had, the Chinese market's pretty close to double that as a percentage of the economy. And so you would expect that it has to come back at some stage. Now seems to be perfect time to do it. they have a narrative, you know, this whole common prosperity to help sort of bring people along with it. And they have the cover of the cover of this industrial boom that's been going on, the goods boom. It's hard to think of when there could be a better time, because if they kick the can down the road for another 2 or 3 years, which they could absolutely do, but it's pretty hard to see how the situation isn't just going to be dramatically worse by the time they have to have that same problem happen again.
Absolutely. Well, while we're on Asia, it's just worth reflecting briefly on Japan, right? Because Japan has been at the negative interest rates, the quantitative easing, buying assets for probably longer than anybody, right? And essentially, they have not really been able to turn the tiller around. But it looks as though they might be coming to a bit of an end of that whole set of strategies, interestingly. But I'm not sure what they're going to do next.
My guess is that until we know what they're going to do next, it's pretty hard to see the end of that. Maybe there's an MMT thing. At the moment, Japan seems to be, almost insular in terms of cutting down on the number of the amount of immigration and the amount of tourism and the amount of people coming into Japan. I think from an investment perspective, actually Japanese companies actually look relatively reasonable. Compared to any time they have over the last sort of 20 odd years, they're actually looking, Japan 20, 30 years ago is where China is now. Yeah. Shrink, population is starting to shrink, these massive valuations, over leveraged housing market, and the companies there, they effectively got the companies to take on a lot of the debt. Really, and they created all these zombie companies, and that just meant for years and years and years you had these Japanese companies that just had way too much debt and were just sort of sitting there basically just trying to pay off the excesses of the last bubble, which is quite possibly where you'll see China sort of end up. But I think Japanese companies are actually looking all right at the moment. Having said that, there's obviously you want to be careful as to how much domestic exposure you have in Japan and trying to work out, what their new angle is. I think there's, I think it's easy to say, look, we're going to get away from this. We've finally got some inflation and we're going to start moving to a more normal economy. But every time they've done that before, all that's happened is that they've tipped them straight back into deflation and they don't really have another answer except, getting out and spending more money and trying to sort of stimulate the economy through fiscal measures. I think there's the argument is probably that they haven't done enough of it, despite the fact, they've been doing what they've been doing and they've got so much government debts built up. But I think that it's a bit like, you need to kickstart that economy and kickstart the demand there. And if you're not quite giving it enough to kickstart it at any one point in time, then you're sitting there sort of, keep on doing the same thing over and over again. But if you're not doing it hard enough, then and you're not actually getting enough money out there to get that inflation going, then you end up with the same results. So.
Exactly right. And just acknowledgement to Yogi Bear, happy Lunar New Year. Of course, Lunar is the name of one of the two dogs. Cue the doggy cam. There we go. There's Lunar, still sound asleep. they seem to spend a lot of time in the evening sleeping, but thank you very much, Yogi Bear. Appreciate the super chat. That's very helpful. Now, Damon, there's a lot of questions coming in about the US, and I guess questions about how many rate rises will there be, how frequently will they raise rates, will it do the right thing, and what happens to the Aussie dollar on the back of it. So can we just spend a little bit of time on the US, and I know one place you wanted to start was wages growth.
Yeah, that's right. So this is your bull case, is that we're looking at wage growth, and this is a wage growth done by the Atlanta Fed, and it breaks it up wages into the different categories in terms of the poorest, the people on the lowest wages versus the people on the highest wages. And you can see in there that the bottom line that is the people on the highest wages, and their wages are very weak. They're as weak as they've been any time in the last sort of half dozen years. And the next two lines are sort of the middle groups, which are So the next 25% is sort of about average, basically where it's been for the last sort of half dozen years. And then once you get into that lowest group, the bottom 25%, you can see that's where all these wage rises are really coming from. Now, if that's sustainable, that's a great thing for sort of fixing some of these inequalities, and but more importantly for fixing demand, because the lowest paid workers in the US tend to have very little savings, and basically whatever money comes in gets turned around and spent straight away. Whereas the top 25% are much more likely, if they get more money, to just save that money, and so. Yeah, if the problem is a lack of demand, then this is your best bull case, is that's a sustainable there's sustainable growth, and that's going to keep happening, and it is potential. The flip side, I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of stuff about how much of this is frictional, or is this the fact that now the Fed's going to start raising rates? Actually, this is the market that's going to get hit the most in terms of its jobs. There's questions about the jobs as well, about saying, looking at, say, if you're a fast food restaurant and we have this coronavirus as an ongoing problem, and at any one point in time, 5% of your workforce is out sick, you might need to go and hire another 5% of people. You've hired them. They're not actually working at any one point in time. You've still only got the same number of people actually employed, but at any one point in time, but you've got a much bigger workforce because you need to account for the fact that people might be sick. And if that's the case, and we're coming to the end of Omicron is potentially heralding the end of the whole coronavirus lockdowns and things like that, is that if that's the case, then maybe then we'll have the Fed. Yeah, the opposite will happen, that we'll have the Fed jumping in and raising rates, smashing demand, just as employment becomes quite weak and these benefits from the high wage growth go away.
Absolutely. makes you think, doesn't it? Because the other point to make, of course, is that the government stimulus in the US, which was quite a big package of stimulus, was withdrawn. But the other big stimulus that Biden wanted is stuck. And it's unlikely now to come, probably in the form that it was originally envisaged, which means that maybe that other big sort of force in terms of economic momentum won't happen. And we know that, in fact, consumer confidence in the US is dropping back and retail sales is down and the growth expectations are actually falling back. In fact, the IMF report in their latest forecast took out the Biden stimulus and down forecast growth in the US relative to where they were previously.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you look through the inflation numbers, there's still energy is the number one thing driving it. And so the question is, lots of questions over what's happening in Europe, but the other thing is saying, well, at what price does demand destruction start to happen with energy? And I think we're pretty close to that stage. And so if you want to keep seeing continued high inflation numbers because of energy, you need those prices to keep going. You need oil prices, over $100, and you need the gas price and everything to keep going up. Like, inflation is not the fact that oil's at $85, $90, if it stays there, well, that's the end. The inflation doesn't keep happening. You need that to keep going up all the time. And so, in a way, what's really been happening, we've been characterizing it a little bit as you have a lot of investment banks out there who are all pitching commodities are the thing that's going to save you from inflation. And in a way, they're actually creating the inflation by pushing the prices of some of these commodities up as well. And that's what the Fed has to kill. Like, if it's going to bring inflation under control, it needs to bring the oil price under control. It needs to bring commodity prices under control. And that's potentially where we're headed for, is that that trade of commodities will save you from inflation might be this longer term factor, but the net effect for me is that most of these commodities are trading at record highs or close to record highs, and the natural price for commodities does decline in real terms. So if you look back at sort of 100-year histories or two or 300-year histories, those commodity prices generally come down, you know, in most commodities. Mm. And so I think trying to buy commodities at their very peak prices with this hope that they're going to save you from inflation, I think is ill-founded.
And, you know, thinking slightly further about the US, one of the things that we saw in the last 2 or 3 weeks was very big falls on the tech sector, particularly some of the big techs, you know, things like Tesla, things like even Microsoft at one stage. And yet now they've sort of all come back again, which suggests to me that there's still a lot of free money around looking for those opportunities, right, and trying to make calls on where the value bets are.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the one thing I'd say for people is if you're looking at these markets as well and trying to work out whether or not you decide to buy or not, I think it's a very good idea to be thinking about the markets now, about saying, what are the stocks I do want to buy when the fall comes back? So you don't want to wait for the markets to fall and then start be scratching around and trying to work out what to buy or do I jump in or not jump in. But if, you know, for us, it's about having these lists of stocks and saying, okay, if Microsoft at a certain price, we definitely want to own more of it. And Apple at a certain price, we're happy to own more of it. You know, there's finding these high quality stocks, and then as they pull back. So it's worth noting though that tech is, you know, there's two parts to tech, and well, way more than two parts, but two big parts in my mind is that they should be focused on at the moment. One is the unprofitable side, and the sort of the real hype side of the tech market. And that's the ones, say, that you see in the Cathie Wood ARK fund, those types of ones. And so many of those are down sort of 50% already or more. And then there's the real high-quality, profitable tech, the ones that really benefit from you know, more people using it, turns into higher margins and more, you know, you get a Facebook. The more people that use Facebook or Instagram or whatever, then they end up attracting more and more people, and they get more ad revenue, and their costs really don't move very far. Or Microsoft, the more people that use their services, or Google. So those types of ones that really benefit from these network effects are the ones where you can sort of see that growth comes through. The dollars, they earn another dollar, it flows pretty much all of it goes down to the bottom line, and you know, absent some antitrust and things like that, yeah, they're the companies that we want to be owning for the long term. There's other ones that are sort of more on the hype. So something like Tesla is down considerably from its highs. Yes, it's bounced back a bit, but it's still down. And the issue is it's valued pretty much. Actually, I haven't checked in the last month or so, but you know, it's pretty close to the same value as the rest of the car manufacturers put together. So yes, this question about saying you need to make the assumption that it's basically going to, you know, it's going to overrun the world, and Mercedes and BMW and all these other ones will never be able to create, you know, cars and get back to the same market shares keep their market shares. And so those types, the ones like Tesla, you know, I'm less keen on, and less sort of feel as if a lot of those are priced for like fantastic success. And if they even just have very good success, then the share price is going to fall. And so, so as you're looking at these tech sectors, I guess I'm trying to look for quality tech really at the moment is what I say, the ones that I can see the cash flows, I can see the growth coming through, and I can look at the valuations and say, well, look, you know, they're really cheap, these stocks, but they're not terribly expensive in terms of, you know, Microsoft's and Facebook and Google and things like that. It might be 20 to 30% more expensive than the rest of the market, but I can sort of look at them and go, yeah, okay, I think I can see that, but I can see where the growth comes through to justify that premium. Whereas when you're looking at stocks that are, you know, 300% or 500% more expensive than the market, it's obviously very much harder to try and gauge where that line is of true value. Mm. There's a long introduction to this your original question, but the question about that you're asking about the tech sector is a lot of this comes down to what's happening in terms of the long bonds. And so what's happening is the bond rates have been rising, and effectively what that's been doing is bringing down the valuations of these really high growth stocks. Yep. So if I can borrow at 1%, then I can put a lot of money in now, and I'm not going to get back money for another 5-10 years. But you know what? I'm only paying 1%. It doesn't really make that much. Yeah, the fact it's going to take a long time. But the higher that the interest rates go, then the more that discount rate starts to matter. When you have started paying 2-3%, all of a sudden those cash flows that are happening in the future are no longer worth as much as what they are with 1% interest rates. And so that's why we've seen bond yields going up and the values of those tech stocks coming down. When we get to the stage where, so if we're right, well, I mean, the way my game plan is at the moment is that, you know, if we're right in that we're going to be seeing a policy error, and so we're going to see raised rates too much, these tech stocks probably will keep getting hit. And then there will be an opportunity then to buy them as bond markets start to factor in the future. The only the danger to that is that what we've been seeing is this as I said, this amphetamine cycle where the Fed's talked about raising rates and bond yields rose, and now they're at the stage where the long end of the bonds started to fall to a certain extent, which is what's sort of driven some of these prices back up, where it's basically the bond market saying, similar to what we're saying, is that we don't think this is sustainable, certainly not in the long term. And so, what we're seeing is that at the what they call the short end, so the rates where they're saying, okay, we're going to see these rates come through, that's all being priced in over the next couple of years. But the bond markets are effectively saying over the long term, these higher interest rates aren't going to last. They're going to have to fall. And inflation is going to fall, and so and when that comes, pushing more back to the market, you probably will see, the tech stocks, or certainly the better quality ones, tick up in price at that point.
And the point you make is a really important one, right? Is you can't bucket all the tech stocks together, right? Because there are very different flavors of tech out there, right? From high end speculative to ones that have never turned a profit, to others that are making very handsome profits and will continue to, right? And the relative pricing and the relative trajectory is quite different. I was reading today, somebody was saying, well, Tesla's got a huge potential because its cost base can be driven down considerably, and that will actually improve its profitability, right? But then Tesla's into millions of different things. It's not just cars, right? So it's very hard to get your head around all the things that he's doing under the Tesla brand. So some are more sort of pure tones. Others are much, much more complex and very difficult to get your head around and try and figure out where the value is. And then it comes back to what extent are you caught buying effectively a brand and effectively an individual with a particular charismatic view of the future versus the economic, drivers that are driving some other techs. It seems to me it's a really interesting conundrum.
Yeah, absolutely. And keep remembering, it keeps coming back to price. I mean, I've got no problems with a lot of these, with a lot of these companies that except for the price. It's about saying, Martin, you've got two different hamburgers. I found you the best hamburger you've ever had. And you're like, great, how would you like to pay $1,000 for it? You're like, well, okay, yeah, it was a nice hamburger, but I don't know if I'll pay $1,000 for a hamburger, It's that point about saying there's a price at which everything sort of comes into value, and saying, well, yeah, if I'm buy this other one for a Macca's one for $750 and this one's going to cost me $10, then fantastic, I'll have this one. It's the best one ever. But if the other one's going to cost me $1,000, then maybe I don't need to have that one. And so, and I guess that's where I'm coming back to from in terms of pricing is that, that a lot of these companies are priced for just such outstanding success. All it needs to be is it might still be a fantastic company, but if it's not, absolutely world beating, then the price will fall.
Absolutely. Now, the other interesting issue in the US is the financial sector, right? Because the financial sector is a big part of the economy. It's also exposed to interest rate changes, right? And it's been fascinating to watch the most recent sets of results. Like Wells Fargo put out a pretty good result and their shares went up. Citigroup, on the other hand, did the exact opposite.
Yeah, so that probably leads into the I might throw up a chart on company earnings from the reporting season so far. So I'm going to divert. I've got a little bit of a diversion first. So let me explain what this is sort of showing, and then we'll come back to that question of financials. So what I'm showing here is each of the sectors, the sort of 11 major, so what they call the gig sectors, and the lines on the bits on the side are showing the 10% level is showing the worst 10% of stocks, and the 90% is showing the best 10% of stocks, and then the 50 in the middle is what the median stock is doing. So, and what I'm interested mostly in is what's happening to forecasts. So the bottom two lines. So the 2022 forecast, what's happened to that versus a month ago, and the 2023 forecast. And so it's pretty much, companies are roughly about even. Like, that hasn't really changed that much for most companies in most sectors, which is what it's actually not a bad result. Usually you do see some downgrades, at reporting seasons. The difference is compared to last year, is that last year we were seeing these roaring upgrades right across the board. Even the worst companies were upgrading their numbers, and that's what helped drive the stock market higher. So we've stopped seeing those upgrades come through now. So now it's just basically the small changes to it. The sectors that are upgrading still is the energy sector. So obviously we've seen huge prices movements in there. So that sort of explains those. The other ones are the IT sector and the financial sector. So the financials is sort of interesting in the way that the financial sector, especially when you're talking about banks, they effectively make money by lending it on a short-term basis lending out the money on a long-term basis and borrowing it on a short-term basis. So what they want is what's called a steep yield curve. So if you can borrow in the short-term markets for a low price and lend it out at a higher price in longer-term markets, then that's where they pick up their spread. And so initially we saw some of that, the whole yield curve was moving up. And so that's what was driving the earnings for financials higher. The issue right now for financials though is that we could run into this problem if I'm right, and what we're going to see over the next 6 or 12 months is supply will come back on, and at the same time the Fed will have smashed demand, and then they're in this phase of trying to get demand back up again, so they've got to start lowering rates to do that. Is that the problem you're going to have is not only will you see a flat yield curve, and that will happen regardless of whether the Fed's cutting or rates or whatever. What will happen is the long-term bond rates will start moving down as the Fed's moving up the short-term bond rates, and that's not good for the profitability of financials. And the second thing is you'll probably see the idea that you need to bring demand back to meet this sort of weak supply that we have at the moment means you're probably going to see companies go broke. And that's going to make a dent into the earnings of financials as well. So what I'm saying with financials is yes, they've had some good results, and that's that's somewhere where just before reporting season we were out there actually buying some, picking up some banks, reducing our underweights to banks because we're concerned about exactly this. But it's a very short term trade for me. And it's about making sure, so we're not out of it yet, but it is a matter of sort of watching that and working out if we are genuinely going into this downturn, then banks is not the place you want to be.
No, it's interesting. And of course, in Australia here, the banks' next reporting season will be coming through. I should be looking very closely at two things here. The first is the margin, because last time around, there was huge margin compression across pretty much all of the banks, despite the term funding facility from the Reserve Bank, which was very generous funding. And the other is what they do with the bad debts, because last time round, the results in Australia were not bad from the banks simply because they reduced their bad debt exposure. Right? Now, can you do that if you believe that interest rates are on the way up? Because you'd assume that if interest rates were on the way up, bad debts could well rise.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of those benefits were all the ones, the write-offs that the banks took. And this happened overseas as well. As the banks, when coronavirus hit, the banks basically took these big write-offs in terms of saying, okay, things are going to be bad. We're going to lose hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. And then as it went on and things weren't as bad, they got to then write those back to their balance sheet. Write that back to their income statement. And so that drove that's not just Australian factor, I guess. It drove some of the US results as well, and that's they've pretty much come to a close. So you got that benefit because you put aside too much for losses. And then the question is, if they do have to put away, start putting away more for losses as rates rise. So, yes, absolutely. Look, you know, that's coming back to that chart we spoke about before about the, you know, are we in the greed section or are we in this bull trap section? And that's, you know, that's the real question. I'm not convinced of either one to 100%, and I guess I never will be, but I'm certainly leaning towards it being more of a bull trap than we're going to keep the sort of euphoria stage going for longer.
And certainly in Australia, the most recent credit numbers showed that the banks were lending big mortgages, of course. Now, that's all they do, really, lend for mortgages. The switch away from first-time buyers to some of the other sectors is also there too. But if that does turn around, so if prices start easing and the momentum in the property sector eases back, banks won't be able to lend as much. And that basically means that their only game in town, because they've consolidated themselves out of wealth management and all sorts of other things, right? They're basically big building societies. Well, what happens when big building societies don't actually lend as much for buildings? I mean, that's the really interesting question.
Yeah, obviously volume as well. And I've got a chart up which is affected by, I'd like to show as well, just on aggregate earnings. And so this is across the large cap market for Australia, just showing that, so it's forward earnings. So it basically looks forward sort of 12 months and starts in 2018. And then you can see the big drop down is obviously the start of coronavirus and then the rise up. And so you can see that's I've got the US, the top 500 stocks in the US there. And so that's part of the reason why I don't mind the valuations as much, and I'm sort of a little bit less concerned about the US stocks because we have seen this strong earnings growth. If we look at the Australian line, which is the blue line, and so that, and keep in mind as well that this has got commodities in it. So commodities have been pretty strong in recent months. So earnings have sort of been falling back over the last sort of 6 months at an aggregate level, despite the fact we've got record high commodity prices in a number of different sectors. And so you take those out and then you take the banks themselves out and the picture looks a lot, you know, doesn't look particularly healthy in the Aussie market. You know, you need to be quite careful and selective, I'd say, as to what you want to buy in Australia.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it certainly is a market of, multiple facets. And I've been watching some of the, the resources sectors going up and down like a yo-yo in recent times with the iron ore price and with price of gold and all those sorts of things. But remember that the financial sector in Australia is a huge proportion of the overall market. And so, you know, whatever happens to the financial services sector, which aka mortgage, frankly, predominantly, really does have a huge impact on overall profitability, overall returns, overall superannuation performance. This could be a big deal if, in fact, we're at the sort of the peak of lending, because our economy in Australia is much more narrowly based than in the US, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. We're not as bad as China, but we're doing a reasonable impression in terms of trying to get as much, you know, in terms of houses as we can. So I think there's a lot of our manufacturing sectors and sort of other sort of non-resources, non-housing sectors are very, very small relative to what you see in any other developed economy. And that's a problem for Australia is you know, we're relying really upon China wanting to keep this whole property market from not imploding. That'll hold our iron ore prices up and our commodity prices and in turn the banks. So, yeah, I think there's certainly – I can see a lot – it's a lot easier to see problems in the Australian market than what it is offshore. Not to say there's not problems. You know, it is easy to see problems everywhere at the moment, but trying to work out how much exposure you need to have to the market in case in case we are in, you know, we do have this other leg up and the Fed reverses and it's and it doesn't even need to do anything. It just needs to talk about, you know, maybe we're in a phase where they don't even need to do anything anymore, Martin. You know, all the reserve central banks just need to talk about what they might do and markets will move and they never have to do it.
Force of mind, right? I just think it and it happens. You don't need to do anything exactly. Yeah, well, scary if that's the case. There's an interesting question here which I want to put up because it actually leads on quite... Whoops, push that button first and then push that button. This is the question of the pension funds or superannuation funds and specifically the forward commitments. And I guess one of the things I've noticed is that quite a few people have gone into annuities. In other words, what they've done is they've taken a chunk of their savings, you know, be it superannuation or not, and has converted it into a cash flow over N years, in some cases, no end years. You are banking completely on the physical and financial strength of the entity that's actually now generating the annuity, aren't you?
That's right. And a number of these companies back it with property, effectively. Mm-hmm. So if you look at something like a Challenger, which is, I think, if they're Australia's biggest, but they're pretty close to Australia's biggest.
Yep.
Yeah, most of the annuities there are backed by property. So, and it's often, you know, very, very high quality property. You know, it's leased to governments and, you know, on long leases and all these things like that. But if the property market suffers over a long period of time, then you are in effect exposed to a leveraged play on that. I mean, effectively what they're doing really is they're saying, Martin, you give me your money and I'll get you money from another 1,000 people like you. I'm going to take all that money. I'm going to buy a property with it. And I'm going to use the rent on that property to pay you. And I'm going to take, and that's, you know, the rent's going to be paying me, I don't know, 5%, 6%. And I'm going to take that and I'm going to pay you 4%. And so on your annuity. And so I get this, you know, I get this margin in between. But the problem is if you do go through protracted downturns in terms of the value of those, then that can be problematic for the companies involved. So,
yep.
Keep in mind, it's not a riskless bet, I suppose, in terms of what you've taken.
And that's the point. You may have got a guarantee of, you know, a certain percentage return, right, which is sometimes inflation-adjusted, by the way. You know, you can get inflation-adjusted annuities. But there is a set of risks below the waterline, which are not, I think, adequately disclosed, frankly. And very often people think of it as a risk-free alternative to direct, you know, investing in the markets. And I just wonder sometimes whether people really know what they've got themselves into.
Yeah, well, I guess it's a question about saying if you turned around and said, I'm going to lend money to AMP or to Challenger on a personal basis, I'm going to, you know, write a check for $1,000 and give it to them. You're saying, well, okay, I want a high return on that. You know, I want it because that's a company that can go bust and, you know, I want to make a certain return to justify for the risk of giving them that money. And then when you're giving them an annuity, you're doing something very similar. It's not quite the same. You do sit, you know, further up on the chain if things go wrong and, you know, you're much less likely to lose everything. But you are in effect still taking on some credit risk. And so, it is another exposure to usually Aussie property. That so, people will have within you. So, you know, you might be sitting there going, well, I'm nice and diversified. I've got, you know, I've got some hybrids, which are all banks, you know, bank hybrids, which end up being a link back to property. I have my bank shares, which are a link back to property as well. I've got my own house that I'm living in. I've got an investment place and I've got these annuities. And then you're like, okay, I've got six different flavors of property, Australian property exposure.
Yep.
And I think in terms of diversification, well worth thinking about, treating that as...
And your earlier point's really interesting, right, that the Australian market compared to, say, the US market is probably the Australian market's looking more risky and therefore, yes, from a risk diversification perspective, being all in Australian stocks, shares, whatever, right, is probably quite risky at the moment.
Yes, absolutely. I'd say, where we're sitting – we're sort of starting to run the, we spoke about the Aussie dollar, where it was, that the dangers are that you get interest rates in the US do go up and we see interest rates in Australia not follow suit because of the, you know, differences here. We see the Chinese property sector could easily keep slowing down. And you know, that results in our two biggest sectors, you know, resources and financials really doing it tough. And that drives the Aussie dollar down. And you know, as a relative relative play, it's we're certainly far more underweight Australia than what we are international stocks.
Yeah, very interesting. And when it comes to the other interesting question that people threw me beforehand, right? They were drawing comparisons between March 2020, you know, when we had that big fall down, where a lot of people bailed out of the markets thinking that things were going to get even worse. In yep. some cases, of course, they sold, you know, when things were actually falling, which meant that they didn't have the money in the market when things went up, which means they missed out. To what extent are we seeing the same thing again now is the sort of question I'm getting. You know, in other words, should we be thinking about it the same way as back in March 2020, which was a significant drop but then a significant recovery, or is yep. it structurally different this time?
Yeah, look, I think it's different. Can I throw up that graph again, Martin? What I wanted to show. So, I mean, effectively, March 2020 was the despair stage. And that usually lasts a while. Like, you know, we obviously threw so much government stimulus at it, at the problem. And then we had the benefit of, you know, getting the vaccines up and running, you know, far faster than I guess we ever have in the past. And so that sort of, that drove us out of that despair stage really, really quickly. I think what we're asking is something different at the moment. I don't think, you know, to me, a 10% pullback isn't like we haven't been through this fear, capitulation, and despair stages. I know our cycles have sped up, but usually that's a, you know, that's a multi-year process, or at least a, it's a multi-year process usually to come up with that. I do think we're either basically still in this greed and delusion phase, and we've just had a pullback, just a, you know, a market pullback on the way up, and there's still more to go. Or we're in this bull trap phase where, and it really comes down to government policy and whether the Fed's doing the right thing or not. If there's a policy, you know, every time I'm here, I just keep saying, you know, we're held in the hands of governments. We have the US government, doing like a massive pullback in terms of the amount of spending. And when you might say, oh, well, what about the infrastructure plan they did get through? You know, there's $1 trillion there and all these things like that. I'm like, yes, but it's less than what it was last year when they're throwing more money at it. So we've got this massive big fiscal contraction. And at the same time, we've got, our central banks saying they want to smash demand in order to bring it back down to the low level of supply that's available at the moment. And I think there's a pretty reasonable chance that that there will be a policy error. It's not 100% either way. So, you know, you do need to keep some investments, and, you know, it's a question about how much you get out and how much you know, you can sit on the sideline forever thinking bad things are going to happen. But I'd be, you know, I'm very cautious at the moment myself. And so, you know, still got investments, obviously. We've sort of got about 20-odd, something like that, percent cash sort of sitting waiting to buy a dip. For me, you know, as I've spoken about a lot, it's not about saying you're all in or you're all out. It's about really leaning into the cycles. And to me, we're not at the point where you should be, going all in and throwing everything onto the market with the expectation that it's going to go to new highs and valuations are going to, continue on their way up.
Absolutely. Now, there's two other topics which people threw me questions at. The first one was oil, energy and oil. We know that the prices have moved up strongly, right? I think 12% higher through the month of January. We've got the potential conflict in Eastern Europe and, Ukraine. We've got issues of supply. We've got gas pipeline issues as well. So a lot of hedge funds have been piling in to the energy sector. What's your perspective on that? Are they seeing it right, or are they missing the downside?
It's when you look at all the surveys, it's the most loved sector out there. And a lot of it's driven by this idea, sort of emanating from Wall Street, is that what you're seeing from most of the big banks there is they're saying, inflation's high, you got to protect yourself from inflation, you got to buy commodities, and one of those, the biggest commodity out there is oil, so buy oil. I don't I'm not subscribing to that. I'm lightening up on the oil where I can, or starting to anyway. It's a you know, the whole argument about there not being enough, that there's not enough supply, and the demand's going to come roaring back. I do think oil's been affected by coronavirus the same way that every other supply has. So, you know, the problems of getting engineers and getting people out and having running full suites of production faces it as running into the same thing. And so I do think that supply is quite strong, and I think the current high prices are driving as much extra supply as you can. And there is a level where, you know, obviously, EVs are still in their early stages, but at high enough oil prices, it becomes attractive to switch across. So, you know, your rough maths are that you pay extra for a battery, and but then you get much cheaper fuel costs. So, you know, you pay whatever, call it $10,000 extra for a battery, and now you get to run your fuel costs at $2,000 or $3,000 cheaper than if you know in a per year in a car versus having a petrol within the car. So if that though turns into and that $10,000 keeps coming down, so if that $10,000 turns into $9,000 next year, and all of a sudden you're no longer saving $2,000 or $3,000 a year, you're actually saving $4,000 or $5,000 a year because your petrol costs have gone up. Then people start looking at it very differently, saying, okay, it's no longer a 4 or 5 year payback to get my payback on the battery. Now it's a 2 year payback. I think we've seen very much with solar power in Australia. You know, once you hit that stage where people can actually genuinely go, right, there's a couple of years and I've got my money back, and then it's all gravy from there, people are very willing to do that. And so, I do think there's a limit to, you know, how high you can sort of factor in oil prices going before you genuinely get that demand destruction. And I don't think we're that far off those levels, you know, even as we speak.
Absolutely. I tend to think that when all the hedge funds publicly say we're going heavily into oil, that's the time to go the other way.
Yeah, that's right. And when it starts becoming public like that, I mean, and that's with any investment. When investments start to become public and people are telling you, widespread about how much that is, they're looking for somebody to take the other side of that trade.
Absolutely.
Because when you build up a big position, you can't just, if you're not a retail investor, you can't just turn around and go, yeah, I'll sell my entire position tomorrow. You go, I need somebody to pick that up. And so, you know, I need to convince other people, this is a great idea.
And you've mentioned a very important thing, retail investors, right? And it's worth just reflecting how much of the action currently and over the last 6 months has been driven by the retail investor compared with the more professional or, you know, the bigger funds. A lot of those people, the big guys, are still sitting on the sidelines. A lot of the action is actually in the retail investor side. And in fact, the volumes over the last month have been quite low.
Mm. Yeah, but margin debt's still really high. Like, there's a number of things out there that, you know, the amount of so this is always your concerning signs. As you start going through your concerning signs, you go, okay, well, what's happening with margin debt? Have people been borrowing money to buy the shares? Because that's the problem. When people borrow money to buy shares and then the shares go down, you have all these forced sellers who are like, yeah, I don't want to sell that stock, but I have to because my margin loans come due. Options, too much stuff in the options market can be similar in terms of, that people have bought the money, bought these call options or whatever it is. These can expire worthless. If the shares fall, they expire worthless. They're a leverage play. And you have the, when people buy options, the market makers behind it have to go and do things to hedge it so they're not going to lose money. And that effectively sort of pushes markets in particular directions. And so if you're concerned that that's really high and that's, you know, option trading is really high at the moment. So I can go through a whole bunch of other factors, but, you know, some of your two big ones is that, you know, it's about the leverage. You've got leverage from options, you've got leverage from margin lending, both at high levels. You should at least be concerned. And, knowing that you might want to keep on playing and you keep dancing, but you want to dance pretty close to the door,
yep,
in case the whole thing reverses. And so, you know, we saw it, a pretty decent pullback in January, and it all happened very, very quickly. So I guess if it's trying to maintain this, if the Fed's making the right decision and everything will be fine, or if you think there's a policy error coming and we're in that next down leg.
And interesting, of course, margin calls have been quite significant for some people who actually found that they were actually on the wrong side of the trade and had to pony up more money, whether they wanted to or not. And so that's the other point to bear in mind. And there are a number of inexperienced investors, some would say speculators, who actually have been caught by what's been happening and this volatility. And if you go back over the month, the volatility has been pretty remarkable, right? Even intraday, right? So, you go back a few days and middle of the day it was up and then it sort of closed down, or it went down and then went up. That is a sign of, I think, something quite important.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly looks like a market where, they call it the fight between the bulls and the bears is, it's back and forth one day or the next. Is there more sellers or are there more buyers? And sort of that bounce around is generally the sign that there's certainly a lot of concerns out there, and you often see that before markets fall. But then again, you can see the same scenarios happen and markets don't fall. So, it's one of those ones to say it's often something you see before it falls, but it's not like the markets fall every time you see that happen. Yep. This is probably the right way to put it. Yep. And the other thing I was going to say on the margin lending is, the volatility. Yeah. Is it it's a volatility part where people are in a margin that they've bought a stock for $100 and they've got $60 worth of debt there and $40 worth of with their own money they've put in, and next thing you know the share price is down 20% and now they're actually asking you you need to go and sell that stock or go and put more money in, and people don't have the money, and so then they've already got a whole bunch of these ones. They got the debt because they didn't have the money to get as much investment as they did, and then they're a forced seller. Now that share price might bounce back to the original price or close to it or whatever, or above the point where you're forced to sell. But if you're forced to sell, you no longer own that stock. So the volatility can, even if you're sort of going, well, I bought it for $100 and it's only at $95 now. I haven't really lost that much. But if you've got a margin loan and it's gone from $100 back to $70 and then back up to $95. You might have been stopped out and you've had to sell everything at 70. And so, so that volatility can cause lots of other problems within the, as it's happening.
Mm, absolutely. Well, the last thing I wanted to touch on before we finish tonight, Damien, was gold, which remarkably is still sitting at around 1,800 US, right? And every time it seems to run above it, it comes back, and every time it goes below, it seems to come up. And a couple of people were asking me before the show, is this a sign of the underlying manipulation of the gold market? And, we know that there's a physical gold market, and we know that there's about a 50 times derivatives market. It's sitting over the top. In other words, are people controlling the price to keep it roughly in line, never mind what happens? What do you think?
I generally don't think I'm generally against the conspiracy theory when I hear it. I do think people will try and manipulate prices, but the good thing with capitalism is there's plenty of other people out there who are trying to manipulate the manipulators and trying to there's lots of money on both sides, and if there's a dollar to be made, then there will be all of a sudden people will be no longer as friendly as they used to be. So having said that, okay, so what do you benefit from gold really is if we start seeing that, say you spoke about Russia invading the Ukraine, that's quite a possibility where gold could see some benefits from it. You do get lots of different things with real interest rates and different scenarios where you can see gold is beneficial. We actually bought a little bit more gold, earlier on, probably 3 or 4 weeks ago, just with the view of going, look, there's so much uncertainty around. We want to hedge some of our positions, and if we get some stuff wrong, or if scenario A happens or scenario B, we just want some more exposure to that. So I'm happy to have that there as a hedge on other positions. I'd just be nervous when if we'll often speak to people who are saying, look, I'm really concerned about stock markets and concerned about banks and all this type of stuff like that. And so I've gone and put, 90% of my wealth into gold. And you're just like, well, have you seen how volatile the gold price can be? And that's just in, and it is priced in US dollars as well. When you convert it back to Aussie, you often get in a little bit more volatility. Gold is, to me, is a, it could be a small part of your portfolio as a hedge. You really are relying on what other people think. So the amount of industrial actual use for gold is swamped by the amount of gold that's bought by central banks and by investors. And so it's really a sort of bit of a second derivative. You're making a bet on what other investors are going to do. And I'm not particularly comfortable putting too much of my wealth into that. It's a small holding in a diversified portfolio for me. When you're putting all your money into it because you're worried about other things, I'd be concerned about how much risk you might be taking without knowing it.
Mm, absolutely. Well, one of the interesting observations from, the Nucleus Wealth portfolio approach and what the World Fund is how transparent the whole process is. It's painfully transparent. People can actually see exactly where you are taking positions and what positions you're taking. Unlike a lot of the big superannuation funds, I was talking to someone the other day who was in one of the big funds and they actually approached the fund to get more information about the way that the fund was constituted, and they refused to give the information.
Right, and sometimes they don't know though. The thing is, they might have 20 different fund managers they're using, and the real answer is they don't know, and it will take them a long time to work it out. And so, they don't want to go and if you're somebody with $50,000 or $100,000 with them, and they're a $100 billion fund, is like, well, sorry, Martin. Haven't got the time to answer your question because I've got to go to 25 different fund managers and ask them and get the answer back. So
where I was heading with this sort of thought process was, in the current environment with so much uncertainty and so much volatility, surely more than ever, transparency, so you can see what's going on, actually becomes ever more important, doesn't it?
Look, I'd love to hope so, because what we find is a good example is, we won't be pulling back on equities, and people can look at what else they own, and they can see in their own portfolios and go, well, I feel comfortable with this much equities, and I can see that's what Nucleus Wealth has already got, and so I don't have to worry about what do they have and what don't they have, as opposed to with a super fund where you're like, okay, I know I'm in this fund, it could be somewhere between 70% equities and 90% equities. There's a 20% band there. I don't know where they are at the moment. And as you said, quite often they won't even answer you, or they'll say, oh, no worries. You're really interested, Martin. That's great. Our quarterly research report will come out in another 2 weeks. We'll show you where we were in December. And you're like, well, yeah, but I want to know where you are now. It's like, well, wait another couple of weeks and we'll give you our quarterly report. And then in 3 months later, we'll tell you where we were in, right now. And so, I think that for me, it's about trying to give people the comfort, saying, we're not going to get every call right. But we will at least be open as to what we're doing and why we're doing it. And we do have people, who come to us and will then say, I disagree with you at the moment. Can you flip me into a different portfolio with a different weighting? And then we do. And then when our views realign, they pop back into the other funds. And so, I think hopefully it's the way of the future in terms of letting people have the transparency and letting people have more control if they want it. And not to say that everyone has to, but at least it's there for anyone who is interested or concerned at particular times.
And when you overlay on the top of that the question of the funds and the fees and that are actually attached to them, right? That's the other thing that people actually quite often miss, because unfortunately, yes, the overall performance of the fund, as quoted, won't necessarily be the performance of your fund or your bit of the fund because of the fees that are actually also being taken out through the process.
Absolutely, and there's layers and layers and layers, and so you're not always seeing what the underlying fees are. So you'll quite often see if you buy a say you went to a normal robo advisor, they might say, oh, look, your fees are whatever, 0.4%, but what they're not saying to you is, well, and we're buying exchange traded funds, and those exchange traded funds all have another 0.3 or 0.4, and so your actual net fail, you're up to 0.8 as you think. Whereas, you know, in terms of what we're doing, we're either doing it in our own name, so we're either buying individual stocks, so you don't have those double layers of fees, or in the case for people with lower balances who are, we're actually breaking that out and saying, look, here is your fee, and we have rebated on some of the lower, lower balance accounts, just to try and balance out what people are paying.
Absolutely. And it goes back to, it's worth asking those extra questions about, you know, what's in the portfolio and what fees, because it makes a huge difference. And, you know, if you think about the value on value over years, you know, the accumulation of effectively compounding, if you have those fees being taken out every year, then the effect of compounding is weakened considerably. And in fact, the story is that if you go back over 20 years, the fees can make a hell of a difference to what the actual outcome is.
Absolutely. And that idea that you're really looking into your fund to see what your fees are, we're quite often surprised at what we see from clients coming to us from other places who are sort of saying, oh, no, I'm only paying 0.5% in fees, or only paying, you know, whatever percent in fees. And then when you dig in, you're like, no, that's just your advisor fee. Then you've got, bang, you've got an administration fee and you've got a fund fee underneath that. Sometimes funds are buying these other funds. And so those fees are like, you know, you can, you can stack them up and people just don't, they've been shown one level of fees without showing, all the other ones.
And ASIC has been very critical of the disclosure on fees, right? And they actually admitted that not all those layers of fees are actually communicable, transmittable, or even visible. So the regulators have given up.
Yeah. It's yes. Whenever we're doing comparisons for people who've come to us and looking to see what they're paying versus and get a more direct one. Quite often they'll say no, you're way more expensive than this other one, and we'll like come back and have to do that calculation for them. They're usually very surprised at the actual levels.
So there's a couple of people in the chat saying, well, maybe property's better because, it's maybe a bit more visible and maybe there aren't so many fees and things attached to it, right? I mean, what's the long-term view, right?
The property fees. The property fees are, if you want to go somewhere for low fees, don't go to property. Yeah. Like you're going to entry and exit costs together, you're probably going to dust 10% from your average property fee. Yeah. And look, if you look at an unlisted property trust, most of those unlisted property trusts, they start by, and if you look at their numbers, they'll actually say, okay, Martin, you give me $100, right, I'll give you $93 worth of property.
Yep.
And you're like, I lost 7% on day one.
Yeah.
It's like, that's government stamp duties and fees and this, that, the other, and commissions here and whatever. You're like, okay, now we're going to start going. We'll get that 93 cents back above a dollar. Like that's your day one. And it's effectively the same as, if you go into a residential property as well, you're effectively doing the same thing. You're saying, I'm going to buy this thing and I'm going to pay all this money in stamp duty. And that's, that's a reasonable proportion, can often be, 1% or, 100 grand or something in stamp duty that you paid, and that's effectively a fee. Yes, it hasn't gone to an investment manager, but it's gone to the government instead. But it's still a fee that's come out of your investment, and so you're starting. Yeah. So fees, absolutely. Have a look at your property and take into account your accounting and stuff like that as well. You need to do absolutely. So.
Yeah.
If you need to spend extra on that.
The vision I have is, how many people are in the background there clipping the ticket on the way through, right? Because often it's not just one party, but there's multiple parties all taking a bit of the clip, clip, clip as you go through, right? And when you add it all up, it really is quite astonishing how many hangers-on there are that effectively are profiting off the back of this whole investment world that we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, if anyone who's being told they should buy a property in an SMSF, that's the one where you really need to look at the fees, because they're horrendous when you add them all up, and you're just sort of going, you got 100 grand in super, and you're saying, okay, well, if I'm paying the average super provider, you're probably going to be saying somewhere between 0.8 and 1.2, something like that. So you're paying a grand a year, say, in to have that in yourself in a super fund that's not self-managed. And then you go, oh no, but if I can go and borrow $400,000 and, you know, at an 80% leverage, and I can go buy an apartment for $500,000, and there's my super, and I'll, you know, that'll pay for my retirement. And you're like, okay, great. So you're now paying, you know, probably a financial planner $1,500 a year, maybe two grand a year to do all that for you. You're gonna need an accountant in there. You're gonna need to have your audit and all these other things like that done within it. Quite possibly they want insurance for you as well. You need to buy some extra insurance, like life insurance and things like that. You might end up paying $4,000 or $5,000 a year just in fees. But this is before we've talked about stamp duty. And so you're like, okay, well, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 a year on $500,000 is only 1% still. It's like, no. You've got $100,000. You haven't got $500,000. You're paying $4,000 or $5,000 in fees on $100,000 investment that you made. You know, you're relying on that whole debt to lift you back up again. Like, the fees in like, I've just scraped the surface, and you know, there's all these other bits you can get from, you know, you got to pay mortgage brokers and banks, and you know, on and on and on. In terms of the SMSF properties, the fees there are incredible.
Absolutely, and unfortunately, a lot of people are misled and given half information on the way in, and then discover what they've entered into too late, right? Because once you're committed, it's very hard to unwind it all, and incurring a huge amount of cost.
Everyone's taking a fee because they're telling you, Martin, they're saying, you know, I'm going to get $1,000 a year. Like, your accountant knows that they're going to go, you know, you go to your accountant to do your tax return, and you know, you're paying a couple $100 probably a year to get them to do your tax return. You turn around and get them to do your SMSF for you, and especially with a property in an SMSF, and they're charging you $1,500 or $2,000. They've just turned you from a $200 tax client into a $2,000 client. Yep. Of course they want you to do that. And then you speak to the mortgage broker. Well, he's going to get a clip for doing it. So of course he wants you to thinks you should do it. And then you speak to the person, you know, you're buying something off the plan or whatever. And so the salesperson's there taking a clip. Of course they want you to do it. The bank tells you that, you know, this is a great idea. You know, everyone involved there is all clipping the ticket. Yep. And everyone's telling you, Martin, it's a great idea. You know, go and turn your $100,000 into, you know, we want $4,000 or $5,000 a year from you.
Absolutely. Yep. And not just one-offs, right? Every year. That's the problem. Well, Damon, we've pretty much come to the end of the show. There was a question earlier on about options, but I decided I wouldn't go into discussing options in the current environment because that's going to be a too long a conversation, but maybe we'll pick that up on another occasion. But I just want to
say...
Go on.
There's a risk, and there's a risk parity part as well. I was thinking it's probably worth raising as well. One more risk that's out there. There's a strategy called risk parity where people buy, they basically leverage up their bond portfolios. Long story, but the way things have moved in January would actually say that these people who follow this risk parity trade are probably going to be deleveraging over the next month or two. Mm. And so there's one more tail risk that sort of sits in those options markets and leverage markets that sort of, worth watching. But let's talk about that more next time.
Absolutely.
I'll put up some slides to simplify some of the...
Yeah, no, I think it'll be good because I think it's an area that people probably would benefit from a bit more sort of detailed thinking. A couple of people asked, this is one, what your management fees are. I'm not going to suggest you say now, but the point is, if people want to find out more about, you know, what the World Fund and Nucleus Wealth, there's a good load of information there, including some of the fee stuff, readily available on the site, right?
Yep, and it goes from roughly 0.5% to a little bit over 1%, depending upon what structure, how much money. Yeah, the more money you put in, the cheaper the fees, and whether you want active or passive. So roughly somewhere between 0.5% and 1% is where most of the fees sit.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, Damon, I want to say thank you very much. A few people said you should get some honey and lemon and have another night, but I thank you very much for hanging in there and taking us through what is a really fascinating part of what's going on and, you know, where we are in the cycle at the moment with so many uncertainties. I think you've spelled out very well the different options and scenarios that are there, you know, and the fact that it's a lot of uncertainty at the moment. So maybe being a little bit cautious is probably good at the moment.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, I think last time I spoke to you early in January, I think it was, maybe it's late, at the end of December, that's right. You know, and I spoke a lot about the uncertainty there. And I think for me at that point in time was me saying, okay, I'm uncertain about a lot of things. I'm just going to reduce my bets. Whatever I thought was going to happen, generally I still thought it was going to happen, but I'm just reducing how much faith I had in that view. Whereas I do feel as if I'm absolutely certain, but I do think it's more likely now we're headed for a policy era.
Yep.
than what I thought. Like back, a month ago, it was like, yeah, maybe we will, maybe we won't. Now I'm like, I'm not convinced it's definitely going to happen, but it does look like increasingly likely we're headed for policy era.
I'm an 80% policy era guy at the moment from what I've seen over the last two or three. When I was listening to Powell giving the answers in his press conference, I thought, uh-oh, he's definitely going to make a mistake. We'll see.
Absolutely. Smash demand to fix supply.
Absolutely. Like, well, we'll do it all again in about a month's time, and by then we'll see where we are. But I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you very much, Damien. It's been great to sharing some thoughts with you on what's going on, and I know the audience have been very appreciative too. So take some honey and lemon and get well, we'll talk again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, see ya. Bye-bye. Well, there you go, folks. I hope that you found that useful. Very interesting conversation with Damien. And just before I sign off, I will just show you that the doggies have been sound asleep. They have turned over, but they're still sound asleep. So I'm afraid not a lot of action from doggy cam tonight. Anyway, thank you very much for spending some time with us. Next week, I will have Veronica on, Veronica Morgan, and we're going to talk about property, what's going on, some very interesting changes in the property market at the moment. So we'll be getting an update from her. So join me next week for a conversation with Veronica. And I want to say thank you for spending your time with us this evening. I hope you found it useful, and I'll look forward to seeing you next time, next week on the live show, or we'll see some of the other shows in between. We put them up every day. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.